All right, good morning. We'll start the class just about 1 or 2 minutes, continuing with the 10 plagues. And we'll be referring to both this past week's Parsha of Bo and the previous Parsha of Va'era. And again, we'll start just in about a minute or so. Once you start hearing the audio feed, just type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. I'm directing that just to people who are joining us online. That'll confirm for us that you're picking up the audio feed properly. Okay, JHS, thanks a lot for that. Thanks for that confirmation. JHS, I see that you have a country code of NL. Where is that you're joining us from? Is that Netherlands? Actually got an email this week from somebody from Netherlands. They had a problem getting into the Masora site. Was that you, or you have no problem out there? I think there was some new software they had put on, and it became a problematic, it became an issue about it once they added the software. Was that you, or was that somebody else? I'm pretty sure it was from Netherlands. I guess there's so much software out there that there's eventually going to be conflicts. It was you. All right, so maybe you want to tell us more in specific, and we'll try to do that. Okay, Rivka, good to see you. And Doug, Cal, good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you guys?
We're good. Rivka, Josh, you still on?
Yeah, good morning, Rabbi. Yeah. Good morning, everybody. It's Rivka.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, Josh. I got Josh asked a good question this week. He emailed me a question, and last week I know I had the wrong Josh, but this week I know I have the right Josh. So I could. This
wasn't an imposter this time.
No imposters this time. Too many Joshes in the world, I think, huh? let's see. Your question was as follows: that. It got me thinking. I think I may have an answer for you. The question was, when the Egyptians saw the plague of lice, and this is in Exodus 8. Let's see. Yes, right. It's after the frogs, but like, here it is. It's in 8:14. So it talks about the plague of lice. It says that that plague starts in 8:12. And it says that God told to Moses, he said to Moses, speak to Aaron, and they should... Matacha. So he should raise up his the staff, and he should smite the sand of the earth, and it will become lice on all the land of Egypt. Verse 13 says that he did so, and he lifted up a staff. Aaron lifted a staff, and he smote the dust of the earth, the sand, and it became lice on man and on animal. All of the land, all of the sand, all the dust of the earth became lice in all the land of Egypt. And then the astrologers, powers, the magicians, using sleight of hand. That's what Lotehem. It says, "V'yasu chein hachatumim b'lotehem." That the astrologers of Paro did similarly with their sleight of hand. I mean, Lotehem is in a concealed manner. So concealed means they didn't show openly what they were doing. Evidently, that was not the case by Moses and Aaron, where they did nothing concealed, and they would just hit the ground openly, and then they would see the entire granules of sand turn into lice. But no, whenever the Egyptians did something, it always says Lotehen, with their concealed manner. And Saad Yagon, of course, says, I think we may have mentioned it last week, he says that they mimicked the blood by pouring red dye into the water, or they put something into the Nile that caused the chemical or something which the frogs were allergic to. That's how they mimicked the frogs coming out. But here it says that they tried to do, right, or they did. It doesn't say they tried, it says they did similarly to bring out the lice, but it says they were not able to. And Josh's question is in the next words. It says, and there was lice on man and on beast. But it said that already in the previous verse. It already said there was lice on man and on beast. So why is this being repeated? Okay, that's the question.
May I say something?
Yeah.
Okay, what I'm thinking is that the Torah is teaching us that the sorcerer, the Egyptians, could not do it. It says that clearly, but yet there was a lice infestation was on man and beast, which was said previously, which shows that it was only accomplished when Aaron stretched out his hand with a staff and struck the dust of the land, that it was only accomplished from Aaron, and it was on man and beast from that point, not after the sorcerers did it. It was already accomplished when Aaron did it.
Okay, good. So it's repeating it.
And then it further says it's the finger of God.
Right.
So Pharaoh was very strong, and, you know, he was very adamant and not heeding to anything that he was seeing until, as we see later on, it came too late, where the firstborn was killed and suffered by losing his own son.
Okay.
Yeah, I read another interesting question that now I think is related.
Go ahead.
How do they, in a plague of blood, how do they get pure water, so they could do their trick? So it seems like, how would they possibly be able to do it if already everything was filled with lice? Why would they find a clear spot that they can turn into lice?
Well, in terms of the water, it openly says that they dug for water on the banks of the... Because since they couldn't drink the water, so the people had to dig for water to get fresh water to drink. Evidently, not everything was turned into blood. It says in chapter 7, verse 24, that the Egyptians, all of Egypt had dug for the water on the around the Nile River to drink, because they were not able to drink from the water of the Nile. So that implies that they did get fresh water. God didn't attempt to kill them in a by thirst. He was just trying to show that the Nile River was not a god. That's why it was the first plague. And perhaps in terms of the sand, maybe they tried to turn other things into sand. Maybe they weren't. Like you're saying, if all the sand had already become lice. So they couldn't turn. There was no sand left. So perhaps they were trying to do something, make lice out of something else. But you see, they couldn't do it. But interesting is that it also says that they did similarly. I mean, it doesn't say they tried. It says that they did similarly, which is a very odd thing, because the magician, the worst thing for a magician to do is to attempt a trick that he knows he cannot pull off. So these guys were magicians, the astrologers. So what were they trying to do? They knew they were not going to be successful. That has to be the case. They're not going to fool themselves. They know what they can control. They know what they've already practiced at in terms of being able to do a good card trick. And to try to do something and then fail, that has to be answered also. But I think what may be the case there is that they knew they couldn't do it. However, they wanted their positions. That's why they were in positions, because these specific people, you know, applied for the job to be Poirot's astrologers and so on. Poirot didn't just pluck people up. So, since they were interested in that post, they had to do something to maintain it. So they made believe that, yeah, sure, we can do it. I mean, they wanted to make believe, they wanted to feign some conviction that they could definitely do this. But then it didn't happen. So then they say the next verse, and they say to Poirot, oh, it's the hand of God, meaning there's certain things we can do, but there's certain things we can't. I mean, also, you have to understand, the previous plague of frogs, you see that they also did the frogs. They also performed that. But what's very odd is, so why doesn't Poirot tell the astrologers to remove the frogs? Now, he goes to Moses. He goes to, it says that Poirot called to Moses and Aaron, and he said to them, pray to God to remove these frogs. Well, if the Egyptian astrologers actually produced the frogs, so why didn't Poirot just go to them and tell them to remove it? So either he knew that there was a certain, there was a difference between Moses and Aaron, and I'll prove to you that there was, that he did see a difference, or he didn't know there was a difference, and then when he saw the Egyptians produce the frogs, then he did go to them and said to them, you know, remove them, and they had to give some excuse, you know, we can't. So then he was forced to go to Moses and Aaron. So you have to deduce things from the verses. That's what they hear. It's just giving you an opening to understand what was really happening. Not every single point is written. You have to work into it. For example, why do I say that Poirot clearly understood that Moses and Aaron were different? Because it says, and this is really what I wanted to discuss today, is that there's a very interesting insight into the entire plagues. And that is, if you take a look at verse 723, which is dealing with Poirot's response to the blood. So they brought the blood. Right, so Moses and Aaron did as God wanted, as he commanded, and they lifted with the stick, and they smote the water. This is 720. So they smote the water that was in the Nile, in front of the eyes of Poirot and the eyes of all the servants, and all of the water that was in the Nile turned to blood. Not a small quantity. The entire river turned to blood. In 21, and the fish that were in the Nile died, and the water became putrid, and they couldn't drink the water. And there was blood throughout the land of Egypt. And in 22, it says that the astrologers of Poirot did the same with their covert, again, you see the word latehem, with their covert actions. The Aramaic word is lachash, which is like whispering, like they did something quietly. Because if they would have done it openly, that means they would have shown the red vial, you know, the vial of red liquid in their hand. So they couldn't show it, then they'd know that they were tricksters. So they had to do it covertly. You see, the verse tells you openly. They weren't doing something. You know, the people believed in magic. They believed that the Egyptians had these things back then. So, but you see, it was completely false, just like it is today. It's just magic. It's sleight of hand. And Poirot became stubborn against them. He was hard. He hardened his heart against. He's not going to listen to them. But now look at 7:23 says that Poirot turned and he came to his house, and he didn't let his heart consider this. So why does it say that he turned and he went into his house? You see, he does this because something's bothering him. He sees this as some difference. So he turns away from it. He doesn't want to face it. That's what happens when you turn away from something. You try to ignore it. Okay? And as my friends in the shul yesterday, they couldn't resist but make the joke that Paro was in denial. So I have to share that with you. I think that joke was said at least 20 times yesterday.
But it's not even funny because he was in denial to the very end until it finally hit him when he lost his own son.
Well, I meant the Nile River because this first play was about the Nile River.
Oh, how funny. I missed that right over my head. Sorry, Rabbi.
I was waiting. Well, how come nobody else was laughing?
We missed it too, but we got it now.
Should I say it five more times?
Oh, that's cute.
So, yeah, the guys were like, they couldn't get enough of it for some reason. But, the point was taken that Paro turned away because that is a rejection. It is a denial because he did sense something. But then it also says he went to his house. And Rabbi Mann once said years ago that going to his house meant that he was going to a safe haven. If we elaborate a bit,
right,
it means to say that he was going to a location where there was no effects of this miracle. So his house was I guess, distant from the Nile River, and therefore he can ignore it. Now, this is where I want to give a thesis as to what's going on with the plagues. And I think if you look at the next plague, what does it say? The next plague was frogs. Now, why was the next plague frogs? The next plague was frogs, and if you look at the clues, and you have to look at what Paro did here by blood, and then what happened? What did God do with the frogs? It says in 7:27, and if you do not send the Jews, I'm going to plague all your borders with frogs. So right away it says all of your borders, and then it says that the Nile will now team with frogs, and they will ascend from the Nile, and they'll come into your house and to your bedroom and on your bed and in the houses of your servants and in your people and in your ovens and on your kneading troughs, and in all of your people and all of your servants will come the frogs. So what I want to say is like this, is that perhaps you can't say for sure because we don't know what God's thoughts are unless he tells us, but it seems to be that the Torah is recording Paro's response to one plague, the first plague, and then it brings the next plague. But what happens in the next plague of frogs seems to match up perfectly to Paro's response, meaning since Paro's response was to reject and ignore and go to his house and to shut the door and block out this plague, so now God brings a plague which is impossible for him to ignore. It's something which permeates every square inch of his house and on his bed. You wanted to shut the door to your room before? You can't now. And this is all in order to open Paro's eyes and remove him from rejecting it. I mean, if God just wanted to take the Jews out, he could have done that right away. He could have killed all the Egyptians and taken the Jews out right away. You don't need the 10 plagues. So evidently it's not for merely the salvation of the Jews, but it was to give Egypt a chance to abandon this culture that they had, this idolatrous society, all these views that they had. So God systematically addresses these things one by one. And he's not only addressing the ideology of idolatry, but also he's addressing Paro, and he's also addressing the astrologers as well, I'll show you. But what I want you to see, if you keep this thought in mind, I think I'll show you a lot of support for the fact that the 10 plagues did not necessarily have to be these 10 plagues. Maybe there didn't have to be 10 to begin with. But what I'm suggesting is that it was something which it started with the Nile, but now depending on how Paro and Egypt would react, that would determine the next response from God. Meaning it wasn't that no matter what would happen, that these 10 plagues had to come. It's hard to think out of the box like that because, you know, in Jewish culture, yeah, I mean, even in art and in the Haggadahs and everything, we're brought up and we're raised with this concept of these 10 plagues, and we read about them year after year. So it seems to be the like iconic. They have to be. They're a fixture. You know, they're as necessary as creation itself. These things had to happen. That's not true. It all depends on what the response is from Egypt. And the proof is that God brought the plagues to Egypt, not to another country, because they're the ones, in their own free will, had developed this type of a culture. So God's response to the plagues by nature, but the very plagues themselves, is a response to man. So if that's the case, it's not a far cry. It's not a big step at all to say that every individual plague was a response as things progressed in Egypt. All right, so I just want you to see that point, and I'm going to try and show you some proofs. Okay, so the first proof is that what Paro tries to do is to be an escapist and to go to some closed-off room where he doesn't have to face the music. So now the next plague, it comes from the Nile as well. The frogs came from the area in which Paro rejected, but now it permeated every square inch of Egypt. So this way, this is now addressing that flaw in Paro, that specific flaw. All right, God's not addressing every single thing with each plague. Maybe just one or two points is what frogs addresses. And the truth is also is that, I mean, there's a dispute whether frogs or crocodiles, what these things were. But if they were frogs, as is the common understanding, so they also make a great tumult, which audibly cannot be rejected. So it's something which cannot be ignored visually. Any of the senses can't reject it, and audibly as well. So psychologically, there was no escape. Now Paro was being forced by God's plague to face the music. He didn't do that right away with blood, because God wants that the intelligence of the person should really be what surfaces here. I mean, you got to realize that this was a mystical and occult type of a people. And to get them to start realizing God, they had to start moving towards an intelligent approach. So that's why God didn't just come in and stun them with something something which was just undeniable. Like, Mount Sinai. That was a different thing. There, it was completely undeniable. People could not deny that this was God. There was a purpose for it. But that was not the purpose over here. The purpose here was to try to redirect the Egyptians towards intelligence, thought, reason. So that has to be done not by stunning their emotions with an overpowering miracle that they just have to accept, and then Paro would just free them, because then it's just freeing them out of an emotional fear. It's not because his mind reached a point where he saw that his idols were nothing. So that's why it has to go in this type of a format. Okay. Now, you see that the Egyptian astrologers, they mimicked blood, they mimicked frogs. So what does God bring next? He brings the lice. And what is significant about the lice is that the lice could not be mimicked by the astrologers. The next step God does is that he starts to address the reaction of the astrologers. Oh, you're trying to mimic it? So God breaks that down, and he gives them something which is impossible for them to duplicate. And eventually, with boils, he eventually completely removes them from the picture, because it says that the astrologers couldn't stand before Moses because of the boils. I don't know if we discussed it before, but the boils are on the surface of your body. They don't affect your joints. So posture is not affected by, a malady of the skin. So why couldn't they stand before Moses? It doesn't mean posture. It means they couldn't stand before him in terms of holding their... they couldn't hold face in front of Moses. They were embarrassed. They were trying to project this status of being superior. But now they couldn't do it because why? The end of that verse tells you. Because the boils were on the astrologers and on the rest of Egypt. What do we care that the boils were on the rest of Egypt? We're talking right now about the astrologers. The verse is telling you that since the boils were on the astrologers, equally they were on the rest of Egypt, that means they were shown to be, they were unveiled as being no different than the common Egyptian people. And it completely removed their status as any superior status, because they couldn't remove the boils from their own bodies. So that's why they couldn't stand before Moses, and that was now to completely remove, because in this type of society, you have to realize that the witch doctors had a big position, and that's what they were here. So that had to be attacked also in order to reduce their estimation of idolatry as being valid in any measure. So the practitioners, the leaders, had to also be addressed. Okay? You see also that in the case of the hail, when it came down, so after it came down, and Paro says, get rid of it, you know, stop the thunder, and so he was terrified. Rabbi Chait explained that this culture was very much in awe of the heavens, and the heavenly phenomena really terrified them. So when the hail was coming down, it was mixed with fire, and there was never anything like this in Egypt before. They were terrified. But Moses told them, okay, I'll stop it, but I know that you still don't fear God. You and your servants have yet to learn the fear of God. Because Moses was telling them, I know you're still going to be stubborn after this plague stops. Then Moses says an interesting thing. He says that the flax and the barley broke by the hail because they were stiff. They were hard plants. But the wheat and the spelt didn't break because they were flexible. They were soft. So why is Moses telling him this? So, as Josh, you mentioned last week, it was a metaphor. He was trying to show Paro a metaphor. But now let's take it to the next step and see how that fits into this thesis. And it fits perfectly, because Moses is telling Paro that you see that the plagues are coming to address you. And every step of the way, how you act, the plagues are coming. So they weren't pre-formatted that they had to be these 10. It depends on what happened as time progressed and as each plague progressed. Another thing I saw this morning, an insight, is that, you know, we talked about the mixture of animals. Because they deified, and you see, we talked also about the headdresses of the Egyptians. If you go to the museums today, you'll see Paro's headdress has a snake on it. And they also had, like, beetles and maybe even the scorpion, too. But Rashi says those were the mixture that came and destroyed Egypt, that they, the venomous types of creatures came. These are the creatures that they held in high esteem, probably because they're distinct from other creatures that they have this venom. But not only was that, that was to break down another facet of the Egyptian culture, and that was the deification of beasts, of animals. But then you had the plague. And I saw something interesting this morning. I didn't see it. I mean, I thought that, why did the cattle get destroyed? Why was that a plague? Perhaps, and this is where we noticed that the verse has said that although that by the mixture of animals only came to Egypt and not to Goshen where the Jews were, Paro doesn't investigate to see if that's true. But when the cattle of the Egyptians die, and he's told that none of the cattle of the Jews will die, then he sent messengers to investigate. And he saw that not one of the cattle of the Jews died in the pestilence. So the question is, why did he send? Why was he more intrigued that we see that he sent messengers to investigate by the pestilence that attacked the cattle, as opposed to the mixture of wild animals? There he didn't send to investigate. Both of them attacked only the Egyptians. So perhaps, there's another angle over here, that perhaps Egypt had a justified feeling, or at least Paro felt, well, at least in pestilence, that really was a bothersome thing to him mentally, or psychologically, because the Jews are treating the animals just like animals. They work them, they eat them, and Egypt is feeling that, you know, we put them up there, we're treating them nicely. There's a certain type of maybe a justification, even, that the Egyptians might have had. And here, Paro saying, we're getting punished, and we're the ones that really treat the cattle properly. So this really bothered him, because the sense of morality was now brought into the picture. And now they're being shown that your treatment of animals, even your livestock, your cattle, your sheep, that you think you treat them better, and therefore that's something which is justified? No. Animals are just animals, and they were being shown that. Perhaps that's what pestilence came to do. Think another angle. Okay, I said a mouthful. Let me just pause here and see if there's any questions or comments.
I think that's great. I think that's so true, because they were deifying the animals, and it was like, I don't know how to explain it in English, except to say that just because you're going to deify something, I'm going to give you a double whammy and show you
But that's not the way to go. And look, even the Jews treat the animals the way they're supposed to be treated. They're not deifying. And they didn't get killed. They didn't. They weren't punished. They weren't destroyed.
Right.
So this is something he was starting to, Perel was, I think, starting to question, if we're deifying them so much, how come they're being killed, and yet the Jews don't deify, and they weren't killed.
Exactly.
So maybe the dawn was speaking, so to speak, but still, he was so stubborn that it still had to go further, and it still wasn't enough.
Exactly.
You think so? Yeah? Good. I think that's the point they were trying to make. It's very harsh. I mean, I don't know how many times I've read through this, you know, each year when we read before Passover and so on, and we have Passover, we read it, but it doesn't really hit home. Thank you, Rabbi. It's
okay.
Very clear now.
My pleasure.
Thank
my
you.
Pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments, questions?
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal?
It seems, too, that the fact that after the Egyptians' animals were destroyed, they had to replenish their stock with buying from the Jews, which made them subservient, in a sense, to the Jews.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Did you see a source on that?
No, that's a good point.
Did you see a source on that, Cal?
I think I did in one of the commentaries. As I was reading through, it said that, you know, they had to replenish from somewhere, and the only place they had to go was the Jews.
So you're saying that's part of the design of that plague, was to make them subservient to the Jews in terms of animal purchases?
It just seems real logical to me.
Right.
That any time you are forced to go somewhere to get your needs met, you feel somewhat subservient.
And what would be the goal of that?
Especially for Paro, you know, he feels like he provides for all of his people and everything, and the fact that then he went to verify that, yes, the Jews did still have their livestock, and now he, you know, if he feels he still has to take care of his people, then that's where he would have to go to provide that.
It seems to me
it makes him subservient to the Jewish people.
Yeah, I don't think his investigation was because of just a practical consideration of supply and demand. I think it was just there was something more that intrigued him, and I think that's because when you're more bothered by something, you want to verify it further. So the question is, what was he more bothered by in terms of the pestilence, as opposed to the mixture of animals? Because in the wild animal mixture also only was meted out to the Egyptians. So that's why I was suggesting. I can't say with 100% certainty that is the objective, or one of the objectives. It just struck me. I just wanted to share that as a thing. But I hear what you're saying as well, that also had a practical effect, that it now rendered them subservient. The only question I'd have is, what objective would that fill in terms of God's plan to break down the idolatrous culture?
Would that potentially have made it more possible for the Jewish people to borrow gold and silver from the Egyptians near the end, because they've already had some commerce, and, you know, the Egyptians have found out, gee, these people aren't just these lower class slaves, but that I've had to buy from them, and so that would create more of an amenity toward or more of a tendency to be willing to loan?
It could be. Let's just take a look. Where is that? That is... it's in yesterday's parsha, right? Give me one second. Yeah, that is in 11:2. right before the death of the firstborn. So in the beginning of 11, God says to Moses, I'm going to bring one more plague on Paro and Egypt. Afterwards, they will send you out completely. They will chase you out. And he says, speak now into the ears of the people, and each man will ask of his friend, and each woman from her friend, ask for vessels of silver and gold. And God will put the favor of the people, the Jews, in the eyes of the Egyptians. And also the man Moses was great in the eyes of Egypt, and in the eyes of Pharaoh's servants, and in the eyes of the people. So there is where we should be able to find the clues as to why. But it seems to be God's doing something here. It says that God placed the favor of the people in the eyes of Egypt. That seemed to have been necessary, which goes against what you're saying, Doug, that there was a necessary act that God did here in order that they will be successful and the Egyptians will respond with their vessels of gold and silver. Right? And if God has to do this, that means that without it, they probably would not have responded. You see what I'm saying?
The particular translation that I'm looking at says God gave the people status among the Egyptians. And
chen means favor. The real word is favor. That they had an affinity towards them.
Well, I mean, that could be because they had already had to go, you know, buy animals, although I'm not 100% convinced, because just because you were forced to go buy an animal from someone else doesn't necessarily mean that you find favor in their eyes.
Yeah.
There are different opinions, too, on whether they bought the animals or not. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I remember reading. And some say that the epidemic only, the plague on the livestock only affected livestock that are in the field. So livestock that weren't in the field, they still had.
That, I think, was the hail.
Nine three, one sec.
Because it says in the field.
Yeah, because it says in the field, and some of the commentators said, yeah, that's how they had animals left for the next, for the hail, there were still, there were animals there. Because they still had animals, the ones that weren't out in the field were still alive. And then others say that, all the animals were killed in this the plague on the animals here, and then they had to go buy them from the Jews. So there's kind of two different opinions, at least, that I read on that.
I see. All right. By the way, your question, I didn't answer yet. Why does it say, by the lice, that there was lice on man and on beast? And then the Egyptians attempt to do it, and they can't. And then it says again, there was lice on man and on beast. Why is it repeating it? Perhaps it's repeating it, like Rivka said, that it's showing you that the state of affairs was unchanged. There was really no effect whatsoever. And it repeats to emphasize that point. Despite what they did, there was no change whatsoever, and Aaron's, Moses' plague was there, and it was something they had to deal with. Therefore, they said the next verse, that, it's God's finger. It's a, they had to excuse themselves. So it's repeating it over to show you that now it was forcing them to, that was the whole goal. The whole goal of the lice was not to reduce, knock them down a notch, these charlatans, these liars, the astrologers. But they covered the tracks, this is something which is out of our control. They didn't admit complete that they were powerless. That wasn't until they actually got the boils. And from that point forward, you don't see the mention of the astrologers anymore after the boils. Then it's just the servants of Paro by the locusts to say, come, Egypt is destroyed already. You just let the Jews go, the people, the servants of Paro were saying. Doesn't say the Khartoumim. Doesn't say the astrologers anymore, because now they completely lost face. they lost their jaws at that point. By the boils. Life, no. They still tried to cover their tracks a bit. So it wasn't the death blow. God did not give a death blow to those astrologers yet. He just showed. He knocked them down a notch. You can't do this. You think you can keep on duplicating? I'll give you something you can't duplicate. Again, just giving enough information to Paro to see a distinction between what God's doing and what the astrologers are doing. What do you think, Josh? What's your question? I'll give you first right of refusal.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to make... I see what you're saying.
Could be another reason there, too. I mean,
I can't think of any objections right offhand to it.
Okay, I will take that.
Yeah.
It was a good observation. I'm glad you mentioned it. Because that actually got me thinking onto this whole area. But I think it's just, it really is amazing how this whole series of plays could really very well be completely a responsive type of approach. Not an absolute need that these 10 plagues had to happen no matter what. No. I mean, that's how God works anyway. So
Rabbi?
It is really consistent with that. Yes?
Rabbi, I just wanted to ask a question. I never saw the way you were saying there was like a progression. I never realized that with each plague there was a progression. It was getting worse and worse because Paro was so adamant. Then okay, we did it. It's getting deeper in my mind that I never realized this before. It's
yeah.
A phenomenal thought that I have now, because it seems that the progression is one escalated to the next, because he could have stopped it. He didn't have to go through all this. He would have just been able to accept the fact that, okay, you know, this is the way it is. But because he was hiding out in his apartment, in his palace, the frogs had to come in to invade his privacy. Because of the different things, one went in way it made it worse and worse and worse. No one ever brought this up before, and I thank you for that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was progression. I'm not saying progression. I'm saying that it's a response, meaning I don't know if every subsequent plague was more severe.
It's a wrong word, but it's a response.
Right, response, because it could have been like
okay.
One plague after the next was not more severe, but it was just addressing a new element that had to be addressed. But you do see, though, that at the last plague, by the death of the firstborn, that is something which, as Rabbi Chait explained once, that wasn't mean that I'm going to come to the Haggadah that we read in Pesach, the Passover, it says that me and not a seraph, me and not an angel, me and not a malach, I'm going to be the one that brings in the death of the firstborn. But God really administered all the plagues. So why is the death of the firstborn being singled out that it's God, and the other ones don't say that? I mean, God did all the plagues. Rabbi Chait, I believe this is what he said.
That's the question. I don't know.
Yeah, I believe this is what he said. That here it was something which the mind just couldn't reject anymore. And it was a clear... literally a death blow physically, but it was literally it was something that they couldn't there's no way you can explain how a plague would only attach itself to those who were born first. I think we said last week that it's as if you say that if people in New York City who were wearing a yellow button on their left sleeve, those people died and everybody else was alive. So that's why it says over here that it's God, because here it was completely inexplicable in terms of any natural law. Okay.
Right.
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, Rabbi. Too. When in before the plagues ever start, don't we have a statement by Hashem that He will bring His hand against Egypt? But it doesn't get specific about that. And so, couldn't it be? I mean, he comes along and he does, basically Moses says, let the people go. Now, at that point, supposedly, Pharaoh had free will. So if he had said, okay, then presumably there wouldn't have been 10 plagues.
Right. That's right.
So it seems to me that the free will argument makes a lot of sense here, in that everywhere along the way, the plague was, at least if nothing else, was a response to the fact that they were saying no. And certainly you're making a really good case for the specifics. But if we take the position that, no, these 10 plagues absolutely had to happen, then it seems like that negates the idea of free will. So I'm agreeing with you, I'm just...
Right, I hear you say. I mean, the first five, Paro had free will, in terms of he could have released them. But the last five, the rabbis say that it was no longer up to him. And God was the one who hardened his heart in the last five plagues.
Right.
Meaning that Maimonides says that the reason for that was that it's to show you that a person could reach the point of no return where God will punish the person by taking away his ability to repent. So that's a very important lesson for all humanity.
That also suggests that, depending on the wording, when God spoke about this before it ever happened, and for some reason the words coming to my mind are that God said he was going to bring his hand against Egypt, that he had to have known that, obviously, that Pharaoh wouldn't respond, at least initially, because if Moses had simply walked in and Pharaoh had said, okay, you guys deserve a vacation, go ahead, then there wouldn't have been any need to bring his hand against him. So it's almost like God is prophesying what he knows is going to happen before Pharaoh exercises his free will to, at the very beginning, to reject Moses' request.
Yeah. I'm not sure which verse you're quoting, but there is a very interesting Rashi commentary where it talks about God's hand, and it says that God brought a literal physical hand into Egypt. That means the people saw a physical hand. So it's like, what? Yeah. Besides the 10 plagues, there was actually a hand in Egypt that the people saw that was hitting them. It says, Yad Mamish Lahakos Behem, that a literal hand that came out and smote them. Let me see if I can show you that. So I remember asking it to Rabbi Chait. He says, yes, but it wasn't God's hand. He created the hand just like he created the plagues, meaning... But now the question is, what? That's a very odd type of a thing to happen. In addition to the 10 plagues, there was a physical hand that the Egyptians saw. And you have one other place in the Torah where that took place. There was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. He was making a party, and they had the vessels of the temple again, and they were rejecting the prophecy that in 70 years or whatever that the Jews would be redeemed, and all of a sudden, God created a hand that was writing something on the wall. That's where you get the saying, the writing, you see the writing on the wall. It comes from that story, that Belshazzar, who was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, he saw next to the candelabrum, which, and it was there to make sure that you weren't seeing things. It was next to a very brightly illuminated part of the banquet hall where he had all his people and his satraps and his officers, and they were all... festive, you know, rejecting the Jewish promise of the redemption. And right in front of the lamp, he sees a hand writing something on the wall that they couldn't figure out. And it says his knees, like, shuddered, and they clapped against each other. He was so frightened what was going on. And but he saw a hand writing something on the wall. So you have another case where there was a hand being used. So, don't think it's an impossibility that if God wanted to, that he can't create a real hand in Egypt to hit them. But what was the reason for that? I believe the reason for that is that when you look, I'll give you an example. A person is in his house, and I'll give you two scenarios where the person, his life is in danger. He's in his house, and his house happens to be built at the base of a mountain, and it's tremendous rain, and a mudslide starts, and it starts to come right for his house. So he has to grab whatever and get out of the house. And a few minutes later, his house is completely destroyed by the mudslide. Second scenario, the guy's in his house, and he sees a car pull up in front, and some armed, masked gunmen start coming in and charging towards him. So he has to run into his car and zoom out of there. In which case does the person feel persecuted? Only in the case where it's individuals coming after him. Because the person knows that a natural mudslide has no will of its own. So he doesn't feel persecuted. He doesn't feel targeted. He doesn't feel that he has been picked out as a specific victim of something. It happens, all right? So you don't have a feeling of anger against the mountain or the rain because it doesn't have a will. But when people are chasing after you to kill you, and what did you do? You feel anger towards them, and you feel that you're being targeted. So it's more of a threat. It's more that you're feeling that you are now being, you know, plucked out and put under the microscope, and you're doing something wrong. You're being targeted. So that's what God wanted to do with the hand. Meaning all the other plagues, the 10 plagues were all natural forces. None of these things had a will of their own. They knew that. But when they saw a hand in Egypt that was hitting them, now they felt that there was something with a will behind all these plagues. That's the one element, that they were being targeted, that they were being picked out by something that had a will and knew them. If it's just natural phenomena, so fine, you can still brush it away a bit. You can still, you know, attribute it to, all right, so it's a series of unfortunate events over here. But you don't feel that you're now being penalized. So that was necessary. That was necessary as an additional layer in order to bring out that point. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I think so.
So you have to see that. But but I hear what you're saying too, Doug, that God knew from the outset, of course, that he was going to hit them. Because he knew the future.
So, I mean, just to digress on that point, I'm at 7-3.
7-3.
And God says to Moses, but I shall harden Pharaoh's heart, and I shall multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt.
Okay.
So, how is it then that they deduce that Pharaoh had free will for the first 5 and not for the last 5? This makes it sound like it wouldn't really matter what Pharaoh did. I'm going to do all this great stuff in Egypt.
I mean, it's not the script as to when he said he's going to harden his heart.
Right.
Right, we have to...
If he had free will for the first 5, then theoretically God couldn't say the second half that I shall multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, because maybe Pharaoh would say, okay, go ahead.
Well, the fact that it says that the hardening of the heart is to multiply the plagues, you see that that's not mentioned again until after the 5 plagues. Take a look at the end of that parsha, the end of that area. Let's just see what that is. This is by the hail, I believe.
You're looking at maybe
9-12. Yeah, I'm going to increase all of my wonders. Right. Yeah, that's already after the 6th plague. So you see that it's first talked about after that, which could be maybe where the rabbis get it from. That the multiplication of the miracles and the hardening was only after the 5th plague. So God's just telling Moshe what he's planning to do. Not that he's going to institute this stubbornness. He's not going to, you know, just fabricate this stubbornness from plague 1. He's telling him it will happen, but we have to study it to see when. Yeah.
I mean, that's like with any prophecy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I'm sorry, I'm not following that point.
Unless you're saying that with any prophecy, you know, God is saying what's going to happen in the future. He's not saying it's going to start immediately, though. So, in the beginning, before even the first plague, when God tells Moses that he's going to harden his heart and multiply his miracles, doesn't mean he's going to institute those factors at the outset. It means somewhere along the line, within the 10 plagues, he'll do it.
Right, but what bothers me about that is that in order to do that, it has to presuppose that Pharaoh's going to refuse.
Yes, because he tells Moses that. Moses knows that the Pharaoh's going to refuse.
But where's Moses' free will then in the first five?
Moses' free will? What do you mean?
Sorry, Pharaoh's free will.
No, when God tells Moses that I'm going to harden his heart, so let's just say for argument's sake that we're going along with the rabbis, and that means after plague five, he's going to harden his heart. So Moses knows, let's see, even Moses knows that too. But he still has to go ahead and give the opportunity, because in terms of, you know, the justification for the rest of the world, and just to show that even though God knows it's going to happen, and even justification for Paro, he had to bring it on himself. See, even though God knows the future, he's not causing it. He didn't cause Paro to be stubborn on his own in the first five, but he knows what's going to happen. So he just reveals that to Moses. But he has free will completely.
Okay. I hear you. Thank you.
Isn't it that although man does have free will, God knows what he's going to choose because God is not bound by time?
Yeah, Maimonides talks about that as being a very difficult question that people ask, that if God knows for sure what you're going to do, where's your free will? So the answer is that he doesn't know things by cause and effect. He doesn't have to look at causes and effects because he's outside of that whole realm. His knowledge is a different type of knowledge, which is not causative. So although God knows something, it does not interfere with free will. And the truth is, you know, it's mind-boggling that people can ask that question. They can say, well, if God knows what I'm going to do, you know, where's my free will? I would just stop at that point and ask that person, pick up the piece of paper right now. Can you do it or not? Isn't it your free will? You're telling me that you feel compelled to pick that up or not pick it up right now? Just demonstrate to the person. I mean, how can you ask a question that God knows you can pick up that piece of paper or not? So you really sense a compulsion right now, either to pick it up or not to pick it up? Of course, they'll tell you no. They don't feel compelled at all. So therefore, if you don't feel compelled, how could you ask the question that everything is being controlled by God? I mean, there's simple ways around those, you know, to expose these people's questions. Sometimes they ask that question because they just want to remove any culpability for not being observant. They will say, hey, it's not my fault. God knows. So now they find some justification somewhere. Sometimes people will do that. If they find the most minute justification for something, that's all they need in order to give them, you know, carte blanche to act as they want and to, you know, live a deviant life. Hey, God knows it anyway. If they would think about it intelligently, they'd come to the realization that they don't really believe that. It's like Paro. He saw a slight thing that the Egyptians did. They duplicated the blood. Okay, that's enough. I'm going home. I'm convinced that, you know, there's nothing so significant about God. So then God goes to the next step and makes the plague more acute, something which is impossible for him to just completely block out anymore. The frogs approach every square inch of Egypt. There's no safe haven. There's no place to escape anymore.
Hey, I have kind of a general question. So we know that God punishes, like, because it's built into the laws of nature. So, you know, you can get punished that way. And also it seems that God punishes you to teach man to improve himself. And also maybe to teach the whole world, sometimes like God will intervene and punish. So, but is there any case where God would just punish a person would intervene and punish a person if it doesn't have any positive result?
No, of course not.
Just to punish.
That would be unjust. That's the opposite of a just God. It actually, I think it's a verse, I'm not sure where, it's in Micha, which says, Lo ina milibo. That God does not afflict from his heart. He doesn't. It's not something that he just does. It's something which is in response.
Like even if, let's say, somebody deserves punishment, but the punishment would really not have any benefit at all. Like it wouldn't help improve the person. It wouldn't help improve the world. it's not part of the way things run in nature? You know, in that case, would God have...
So that's another question. Your first question, your first question was whether God would punish without cause. Now you're asking that if there is a cause, but it's not going to do, and God's punishment won't do anything, will God still do it? No, because that'll be an exercise in futility. God does not do anything futile. So if a person is not going to heed a punishment, of course God won't send it.
Excellent. That's what I wanted.
But now you can ask me. Now you can ask me a question.
Yeah.
Now you can ask me a strong question. So if Paro was not going to listen, so then why did you bring the last five? You can ask me, Naomi, right?
Yeah. Well, that seems like because for the benefit of the world.
Exactly. Exactly. The Mansat Pishmi Bekol Aretz. Let me see if I can find it.
It could be. Sorry.
No, I'm saying, let me just see if I can...
It seems like it's part of the laws of nature that have to go on, and then that, you know, that's the innocent people... I mean, not innocent, but, you know, people who may not be as, you know, deserving, you know, maybe in our eyes with some point.
Yeah, the verse is it's a 9:16, right, where God says, see, now I'm going to send my hand, and I will smite you and your people... with a great plague, right? And I'm going to cut you off from the land. And it is now for this reason that I have allowed you to stand, in order that I should show my power, and in order that my name fill the entire earth. So now it's no longer for Paro, because God's hardening his heart. So he's not doing it for Paro anymore. Paro now got to the point of no return. He doesn't deserve to even have repentance. Now God is doing it in order to make known his name in the land, like you just said, Naomi. Rivka, you had a question? I heard you perk up there.
Yeah, I was listening. I think that was Naomi, right, Naomi? You was asking that question? There's some place where I can't remember exactly where I read, but Hashem, God will not inflict anybody and punish a person if he knows that they're not going to correct themselves. Like just the way the rabbi, the way you were saying this, and there was an example that you had given me one time when I had asked you in reference to somebody who is Jewish but not observant, and you tell them not to do this or not to do that, and if you know they're not going to listen, don't tell them, even though you know it's, like, for instance, why don't you keep the Sabbath? Don't tell them if you know they're not going to, because it makes it even worse.
Well, that right. We talked about the distinction.
Am I remembering that correctly? I think you had told me that
That is a related point.
I think you had reprimanded me. It said, if you know that somebody is not going to listen, you have to be, you know, God doesn't tell people and punish people because he's merciful. If they're not going to listen, then they're going to be really on a worse note with him, that he's going to be even angrier. So better not to tell them, not to, that he would see that they defy him even more.
Yes, I hear you saying. That point was regarding a distinction between a violation that is a Torah violation or a rabbinic violation.
Huh.
So in as much as something is a Torah violation, there you have to tell a person, regardless of what the outcome might be, will they listen or not. But in terms of something which is rabbinic, so then the rabbis say it's better that the person is sinning by accident. Then if you tell him, and if he keeps on doing it, then he's going to sin on purpose, so it'll be worse of a sin. That's what that was about. But we're talking about over here. Now, what was the point over here again?
Hashem would he punish, Naomi had asked, would they punish, would Hashem punish the people?
Oh, right. Will he do it in a case where they're not going to listen? No. As a matter of fact, there's a related thing where I think it's at the Rambam or Nachmanides that in terms of the trials that, you know, Abraham was put through, he was only told to do this, you know, to slaughter his son, because God knew he would pass. There would be no purpose in putting a person through a trial if they were not going to pass. Meaning, the purpose of the trial, which is different than this, the trial that Abraham had were to, I think Maimonides says, two purposes. One is to actualize Abraham's potential, because he had the ability, evidently, because he did go through the test and he did pass it. But had he never had the opportunity, he wouldn't have actualized that potential. And number two, so that raises his reward. Number two, it teaches the world how far a person should go in his love of God, even would slaughter his own son. It's showing you an example of how a person has the capacity to follow God more than, and he could override his emotions, because intelligence is something which is more powerful than the emotions. Most people just don't get there, but you have this example in the Torah to teach you this, that intelligence, and Abraham was convinced of God's reality, and he valued that more than anything else. And even after the angel told him, no, don't slaughter your son, I now see that you love God, Abraham did not recoil and start feeling so rejoiced that, oh, he's got his son back and he doesn't have to kill him. Actually, you know, Naomi, your husband gave this answer. Shia said that why did Abraham then bring a sacrifice? He wasn't commanded to bring a sacrifice after the angel told him, I see the will of God, don't slaughter Isaac. So why did he bring a sacrifice? He did it because he was so caught up with wanting to serve God that his love for his son was still second. His love for God was still first.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
The strength that he had.
You see that, Naomi? Did Shia ever tell you that?
See, I kind of remember it, yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of remember it.
Right. Very, very good answer.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody about kind of this idea with prayer, and I don't know if I was kind of like formulating the idea that, like, let's say if you're suffering, and it's just part of the, you know, you're suffering because whatever, it could be part of human nature, but you, then maybe part of your prayer, you know, to God that you should pray, is like saying, you should say, you know, well, God, since God doesn't cause suffering for any reason, and like the suffering isn't, the person's going through suffering and it's really not serving a purpose in their life, let's say they've, you know, they reviewed, you know, they've examined themselves and they stated, they find that suffering doesn't like help them do tshuva or anything, then maybe that should be like part of the prayer and part of the reason that they should approach God and, you know,
you keep on getting broken off. Just say your question one more time. I couldn't hear you.
I was talking to somebody about prayer, and like one of the reasons that a person should, you know, feel justified in, I know there's other reasons, but in approaching God and asking for a cure for something is, let's say if they have a condition and the condition doesn't serve to help them in their lives, then, you know, since with the idea that God doesn't cause suffering for any reason, for no reason, that maybe they should, you know, with that in mind, approach God for a cure, because, you know, it's like a higher level of recognition of God's system.
So,
I don't know if that was...
I'm not clear on what your question is. What is your question?
So is that like a good approach for, another good approach for prayer, like when a person is, you know, davening?
Is it a good approach for prayer if a person is suffering?
Yeah, I'll ask it later.
No, ask me now. I mean, I just want to, I'm not clear. Are you asking that, should a person pray? What?
So somebody was saying to me that they, you know, which person might be on the phone, but they were saying that they didn't feel like, they didn't feel good about praying for their own needs. And I know that, they say that you should really approach God and pray for all of your needs, but I was thinking of another justification, that if a person has a condition that they want God to help them with, and that they're just suffering, is to kind of approach it and say that the real purpose that God creates suffering is to help man, and if they have a condition that they need help with, you know, that they need cured, and that condition is not helping them, like, improve themselves, and it's just hurting them, then that's like another way that they could approach God for, you know, and ask for help.
Oh, yes. That's a very good point. That a person should definitely say that if he sees that he's got a problem and it's not really helping him and it's getting in the way of living the right life. So certainly that's a very good argument to bring before God and ask God to help remove that impediment to a good life. I agree 100%.
It's like a lot of times people would look at suffering and they question God and they say, why is it that there's the suffering? They don't understand why there's suffering in the world. And I think that is, you know, that's good. That's a good way to approach God and say, you know, why is there all the suffering? It's not, you know, and that's, you know, when a person does pray, I think that would help.
Right.
Yeah, Rabbi, could I just add something? Naomi, I think that's beautiful. This is Rivka. I just wanted to say that in my humble opinion, I think there is nothing that you cannot ask God when you pray. You can pray for help to understand why you're suffering, to take the suffering away for sure, but to understand why you're suffering and to also make it clear how to proceed so there'll be an end to the suffering and you wouldn't have to endure it anymore. Because God, I really truly believe that God doesn't do anything just like this. I mean, there's a reason. There's always a reason. And I think that because we don't understand the reason doesn't mean that there is no reason. We just don't understand it. It's not black and white.
You also have to realize...
ask for help, right, to understand the reason?
Well, yeah, but you also have to realize a person has to accept the fact that not every evil in the world God is doing. So a person shouldn't jump to the conclusion that this is happening because of God and we just don't understand it. Maybe it's not happening because of God.
Well, I'm just referring to the things that are personal. In other words, if somebody's enduring an illness or if somebody's feeling that they're not able to cope with something, that they can talk directly to God in their own way.
Yeah, for sure. What you're saying is true. That I think King David or King Solomon said it. The Rav Chait had quoted a number of times, kol negiei libo, that when you pray, you can pray for anything at all.
Okay.
Anything which plagues your heart, you should pray to God for. Whatever it is. Yes. Don't think that there's anything that's outside of his ability. It's a wrong idea. A person should just the opposite. He has to be convinced that God can address anything. But the prayer has to be an intelligent approach where the person's trying to live the right life and he presents his case before God and how, you know, obtaining this or removing that will help me live the life that you actually want. It has to be an intelligent approach like
right.
that.
Right, okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right, any other, I guess we're getting late over here. Any other questions or comments?
I think we're good here.
Okay, so, you know, let's...
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Okay, my pleasure. So, you know, we'll wrap it up for today, then. Pick up next week again, you know. I keep saying this week after week that we'll go back to Kahelis. But let's just, you know, I'll say it's a 50% chance. We'll do Kahelis, and 50% chance that we will do
a
more...
You're like a meteorologist. That'll work.
That's it. I'm not going to do any more predictions on it. That's it. No more promises. All right, very good. So I wish everybody a good week.
Thank you.
Okay, my pleasure.
A good week, right.
Thanks, Rabbi. Have a good week.
Okay, everybody.
Thank bye-bye.
You. Take care.
Yeah, you well, everybody. Bye-bye.
Have a good trip.